Welcome into this Golf Channel podcast presented by Top Golf. I'm your host, Will Gray. Pleased to be joined once again by Golf Channel analyst and occasional competitive golfer, Brandel Chambly. Brandel, we're a few days out from the PGA Championship, still talking about Belle Reve and all the excitement that was going down in St. Louis. We've got the Ryder Cup on the horizon. Plenty of topics to discuss this week as the golf season rolls right along. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Will. I'm sure we'll be talking about what transpires at PGA for the next 8 months, and who knows, maybe well after that.
It is always a little depressing when the PGA closes, and I guess next year it'll be the Open, and you look at the counter to see how many days until the Masters, and it is far too high, and in the 200-some-odd days, and you think, man, how are we going to get from A to B? But somehow we're going to make it. But certainly Brooks Koepka's victory at Belle Reve was a memorable one. Looking at the four majors this year, do you think that was the most exciting of the four?
Oh, I do. And that's not detracting from the other three, but the fact that the most exciting player to ever play the game, and arguably the best player to ever play the game, coming back from what we all know to be, you know, almost insurmountable hurdles, factored into it. So that alone would have made it the most exciting major of the year. But, you know, what Brooks Koepka did on top of that was worth watching as well.
So we're talking about the PGA Championship at Belle Reve, and we need to start with the winner, Brooks Koepka. And I wanted to get your take on this whole notion from the Koepka camp that maybe he is not getting his just due, or he's underappreciated as a major champion, or at least he was even after winning back-to-back U.S. Opens at Shinnecock Hills. Do you feel like at this point the pendulum might be swinging to the other side of things, or is this just an effective motivating tool for a guy like Brooks who clearly is able to grind it out down the stretch at majors?
Yeah, well, be careful what you wish for or ask for, because I doubt he'll ever again show up at a major championship flying under the radar. You know, the spotlight will be on him. He'll be, you know, watched closely. People will, you know, talk more fervently about his chances, when he plays well and when he plays poorly. I'd say he did fly under the radar to some extent, but it was partly his and his camp's fault, because he didn't do a media tour after he won the U.S. Open the first go-around or the second go-around. Just kind of disappeared for a while. Typically when someone wins the U.S. Open, they go on a media tour through New York City and do the morning shows and do the evening talk shows, and the world gets to know them a little better. You know, there's a quote or two that's associated with them that precedes them into events and elevates their profile. Bubba Watson did it. We talk about Bubba Watson. Jordan Spieth did it. Rory's done it. Jason Day's done it. You know, they've all sort of done it. But I doubt he'll sneak up on us again.
Certainly not with three major titles. It's amazing to think that he's now on level footing with a guy like Jordan Spieth, who has been seen as this wunderkind for years, and we're already projecting him at 8, 9, 10 majors, and now all of a sudden Brooks is at 3, Jordan's at 3, Rory's at 4, and it's an interesting tussle here among the next generation of talent. But we need to talk about the guy that finished second as well, because arguably some might say there were two winners at Belle Reve because of what Tiger was able to do coming down the stretch, making birdies when he needed to on Sunday, and doing everything he could, just coming up a little short of a 15th major title. I think even after what we saw at the Open at Carnoustie, where he held the lead on the back nine on Sunday, this was still ratcheting things up a notch in terms of his ability to focus and deliver in the crunch time. What were your overall thoughts on Tiger's performance this weekend at Belle Reve, and then also just kind of as a cap for his season as a whole?
Well, like the rest of the world, I was completely mesmerized by what Tiger Woods was doing. You know, when you watched Tiger play, and then you watched Brooks play, though, you couldn't imagine how they could be so close, because, you know, Brooks was hitting it 350 yards right down the middle with every swing of the club, and Tiger Woods was hitting it right and left, right and left, and right and left. And, you know, it was just this Seve-esque moment. It was probably the most Seve-esque moment of Tiger's career, in that he couldn't do what he wanted to do off of the tee. So he was having to do things that, you know, nobody had ever really seen. He was having to play golf in a way that, we've seen him drive it poorly, but I don't know that we've ever seen him escape, you know, quite like he did there. So it was very exciting golf, and it was great to see. I've said all year long that I am completely blown away by the golf that Tiger Woods is playing. I never thought I'd see him play that way again. Never thought I'd see him, you know, be able to score, chip, and putt, or should I say chip and scramble around the greens the way he had. So it was great for Tiger. It was great for golf. And it's a great preamble. It's a great way to, you know, put a button on this major championship run, but it's also a great preamble for next year.
Yeah, certainly, you know, the Masters is not as close as we would like it to be, but it'll be here before we know it, and he's already one of the betting favorites, and I'm sure we'll have plenty of time to discuss his chasing a fifth green jacket in the coming months. But it's kind of remarkable when you look at the ebb and flow of his season. He really got a little stagnant there in the middle. You look back at the missed cut at Shinnecock Hills, where he was all out of sorts and wasn't exactly playing well at the Memorial. And do you kind of look at it as a situation where now he's even closer to a victory, closer to getting back to where he wants to be than maybe he even was in the spring when we saw him nearly win the Valspar and go fifth at Bay Hill?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, it was a perfect golf course for him to be sprinting all the place. You know, his misses were so big that he was off in places where he could still, you know, maneuver the golf ball off of, you know, trampled down lie, so to speak. The greens were very, very soft, so that they were conducive to coming, you know, they were receptive even coming out of the rough. You know, I don't know that we'll see a major championship play quite that soft. Again, you know, Tiger's great at hitting his pro shots. We know that. I mean, he's one of the best ever, and he's still one of the best on the PGA Tour, and that more than offsets other weaknesses that he has. But in major championships, typically you pay a bigger price for missing fairways. That was the case at the U.S. Open. That was the case at the Open on the back nine for him. But he didn't pay a big price for his misses at the PGA Championship. And, you know, that combined with stellar iron play and phenomenal putting, which, you know, coming out of the rough, those soft greens, you know, his balls, his golf shots wouldn't have finished anywhere near as close to the hole on any other major championship golf course. So these were unique circumstances. You know, he did play great. He did hit his irons great. But the golf course played right into that scenario.
Well, you mentioned the course, and this was kind of a segue to something I wanted to pick your brain on, because I know I certainly have talked about it this past week on Twitter. I know you have gotten into discussions on it as well, in terms of this was not a major course that we've seen in recent years, and probably not one that we're going to see in the coming years. But what's the balance between a major championship course needing to be up to a certain level in terms of architecture, in terms of performance, in terms of look, versus the ability to deliver, as Bellerive did, an exciting championship, a stacked and star-studded leaderboard, and a worthy champion?
Well, you know, it's the golf course doesn't determine a great major championship. Again, there's been many lackluster sort of, you know, decent golf courses, good golf courses, that have produced the best major championships. You know, Valhalla is one from 2000. You know, if you think about that, Chambers Bay was in, you know, wide open off of the tee and in horrid shape on the greens, and we got one of the most compelling back and forths, you know, in the last, who knows, 20, 30 years. This golf course was extremely soft and predominantly favored one shot shape, it looked like, and it gave us one of the best events of the year. Think about, you know, the blowouts that we've had at St. Andrews, you know, Tiger by eight, Tiger by five, Louis Oosthuizen by seven. You know, we've had, think about the blowout we had at Pinehurst the last time we went there with Martin Keimer. You know, those are phenomenal golf courses, but, you know, I mean, they're more fun to play, they're more fun to look at, no question about it, but it's rare when the golf course is the reason why, or you can actually point to the golf course as the reason why we have a great championship. Now, Now, the back nine at Augusta and Augusta National, obviously we go to the same course there every year, and we all well know that golf course produces amazing things because of the strategies involved at key holes 13 and 15. And thank goodness, you know, the Masters is played there, because it is, from a strategic standpoint, one of the more interesting golf courses ever. But it's not, it's not an absolute that we have to go to a great golf course. There just aren't that many of them. And the players, they know what they're playing for, and the pressure gives us compelling storylines, and the players themselves gives us plenty of compelling storylines.
One more before, or on Tiger Woods, before we sort of shift subjects here. I know that certainly his comeback this year has exceeded any realistic expectations that I've come across. You know, we're hearing this week that Nick Faldo is saying that at last year's Masters Champions Dinner, Tiger told another Masters winner that he said, "I'm done. My back is done." So it seems like even he had a level of self-awareness that he might never get back to the point where he currently sits. And it generally tends to draw some comparisons to what Ben Hogan went through in the 1950s after the car crash, coming back and winning major championships after that. Where do you feel like the Tiger comeback stacks up versus the Hogan comeback, and does he need to win another tournament? Does he need to win a 15th major to really make that a fair fight?
Well, you know, I would throw Tiger's, I would say of Ben Hogan's comeback and of Babe Zaharias. Obviously, they were dealing with life and death situations that were tragic. Illnesses and an accident. You know, the illness eventually took Babe Zaharias' life, and the accident almost took Ben Hogan's life. So they were tragic and emotional, and, you know, they sucked the world in, no question about it. Their comebacks were more sentimental, no question about it, and Hollywood stuff, because it was life and death. But in terms of just what they had to overcome with their golf, I'm not talking about life. I'm talking about just their golf. they pale in comparison to what Tiger Woods had to overcome. You know, we all know that most of Tiger Woods' problems were self-inflicted, but we're not comparing what they overcame so much in terms of their hardship. We're just talking about what it took for them to play great golf. Ben Hogan was playing the best golf of his life. Those are his words. Certainly, it's back to what he was doing when the accident occurred in 1949. And, you know, it took him very little time once he started golf to get back to playing that golf, that type of golf. Very little. He wouldn't have picked up the club until the accident happened in February of 1949. And he wouldn't have picked up the club until November at the earliest. And, you know, by January, he was playing as well as ever had, and won the U.S. Open the next year. Tiger, on the other hand, would have overcome every conceivable hurdle known to man, you know, embarrassment, scandal, physical decline, just with getting older, because he was older than Hogan, physical injury and the worst kind, one that prohibits you from moving. I'm not talking about legs. You know, which are sore, you know, clearly Hogan could walk. We could see that. Tiger couldn't rotate, couldn't move, couldn't sit down. Emotional stress, and then the psychological stress of having pinballed all over the place with his short game. So, you know, when you put all those together, you know, I would say, the way I look at it, that Tiger Woods' comeback was more unlikely. The golf that he played was more unlikely than the golf that, once Hogan didn't die and once his bones healed up, you know, his golf was not a surprise to anybody. You know, him living may have been a surprise, but the golf wouldn't have surprised people. But Tiger's golf surprises everybody. Every single thing he's doing surprises everybody. The whole world watch him bat and blade chips for the better part of a year every time he played, a year and a half. So we all thought he was done as well.
Well, I want to turn our attention now to Paris? Because with all due respect and no disrespect to our friends in Ponte Vedra, there is not currently a countdown to Eastlake. Everyone is counting down the days until the Ryder Cup when we get this thing back underway at Le Golf National, and it's going to be a great event for sure. But I want to look at now, we've got eight Americans that are locked in on the 12-man roster. We've got four picks coming up from Jim Furyk. So let's get a premise out of the way. Do you agree with the notion that Tiger and Phil are both locks to be among that first three-pack of picks from Jim Furyk after the playoff event in Boston?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
First of all, you know, there's just no way you could leave Tiger off because of his most recent golf. You know, who else, if you combined what he did at the Open and the PGA Championship, has played better? You put those two events together. You know, I mean, Molinari, but Molinari can't be picked. So, you know, Tiger Woods should be on the team from what he's done this year. You know, and Phil narrowly missed making the team for the 12th straight time, which is mind-boggling achievement. But when you consider what Phil's going to bring to that team in terms of the locker room banter and knowledge and experience, there's just no way you can leave Phil Mickelson off of that team. You know, you could argue, you could look at the golf course and say, well, he doesn't drive it straight enough for that golf course. But if you get him into, you know, what's he going to play? He's going to play best ball, you know. He's going to play four ball. He'll probably play with one of the other picks that they're going to make in Kevin Kisner, assuming Kevin plays decent over the next, you know, couple of weeks. Yeah, they're definitely locked. I can't imagine that Furyk would go any other way with those two players.
Well, you mentioned Kisner, and that was kind of where I was heading. Now, we remember that Furyk has four picks. He's saving the fourth pick for after the BMW, so you assume that that's going to go to a player that kind of heats up over these first three playoff events. But looking at those first three picks he makes after Boston, if Phil is one, if Tiger is another, how do you handicap the contenders for that third pick?
Well, you know, with Kisner played with Phil at the President's Cup, and they were undefeated. They played beautifully, and Kisner just led the field in driving accuracy at the PGA Championship, which, you know, he finished 12th, so he played wonderful as well. He had the 54-hole lead at the Open Championship. So, you know, Kisner's a pretty easy pick when you look at that golf course, which, by all accounts, the Europeans are going to grow the rough, narrow the fairways, because they think they have an advantage over the United States in terms of driving accuracy. And they do. And they do with the familiarity of the golf course as well. So the United States will need to have a few players that can drive the eyes out of it. Kisner's the obvious pick. You know, Kyle Stanley is another one. And I'm sure Furyk has got Kyle Stanley on his radar. But Kyle Stanley, you know, doesn't have a history with Phil Mickelson, which, you know, Phil's a tough guy to pair up. You know, not too many people you know, can play the type of golf that Phil has played or does play or can mesh with well with him. And already having Kiz fill that role, it'd be tough to ignore.
And then one more, I want to kind of switch to the other side, because just like Furyk has four picks, Thomas Bjorn is going to have four picks as well. And I think the interesting case study right now is Sergio Garcia, who has been a stalwart on the European Ryder Cup team for nearly two decades and has struggled to find his form for the last several months. Looking at a situation where Bjorn is going to probably have to pick Henrik Stenson, he's going to have to pick either Paul Casey or Ian Poulter. Do you feel like Sergio is a lock to make it as a pick in France?
I don't know if Sergio's a lock. I listened to Ken Schofield at the PGA Championship make the case for every night, and Ken made a beautiful case for him, and he just about had me convinced. But, you know, your job is captain to pick players that can help you win. And, you know, okay, you can say that, you know, a player may bring something to a team room, but if a player is so completely out of sorts with his game, I don't think he's going to be that up in the team room. He's not going to have, you know, the kind of aura that you like, especially somebody who is emotionally you know, prone to highs and lows like Sergio Garcia that follow his good and bad golf. So, you know, I'm not completely sold on Sergio. You know, he recused himself of being picked back in 2010. It wouldn't completely surprise me if he did the same for this one. So I'm not sold at all that Sergio is going to be on this team. And I think he's probably giving Thomas Bjorn a bit of a mare when he goes to bed at night.
We shall see. It's going to be a couple weeks from now. It seems a lot of conjecture right now, but a couple more weeks and we'll have 12 versus 12 and the true speculation can really begin. But when it comes down to it, I mean, I know it's tough to say when you don't know the full rosters, but you said that, you know, the European side are going to be able to control some of the course elements. The U.S. side clearly had a convincing victory at Hazeltine a couple years back. As it stands right now, who do you make as the favorite entering the Ryder Cup?
Europe. You know, I mean, they're very close on paper. 8.5, I think, was the last world rank I saw for the 8 that were chosen by the United States, and that made it for the United States, and right at the European side. But again, as Ken Schofield pointed out numerous times, the world rankings kind of go out the windows. You know, we've seen that a number of times. You know, what is important is the job that the captains do, and then who has the home course, home country advantage, which is worth almost 3 points, historically speaking. If you start to look at what teams do when they're home and away, it's right at 3 points. So, you know, and the familiarity that the Europeans have with this golf course and the fact that they're able to set it up for the strengths of their players, and they will do a very good job of knowing the weaknesses of the U.S. side and knowing the strengths of their side and specifically setting the golf course up accordingly. So, you know, it's likely to come down to, you know, the last match in the singles, but I'd give a slight edge right now to the Europeans.
We will let you get out of here on this one. This is the first time that we've had you back on the Golf Channel podcast since you crashed the party and qualified for the Senior Open, which was a very remarkable achievement, certainly fun to track from this side of things. But to let you out here, let's get one memorable moment from your week at St. Andrews, competing once again on the old course. And then also, does this mean we're going to get to see more Brandel Chambly inside the ropes in 2019 and beyond?
Well, yeah, it was a big thrill for me to qualify for the Senior Open at St. Andrews, you know, to get back in golf that way was special, and it was a treat, you know, it was an absolute joy. You know, there is no place world golf just like St. Andrews. It doesn't matter if you're teeing off there, you know, in the afternoon with your buddies, or, you know, in this particular case, I was fortunate enough to play it in a championship. It was special. It'll go down as one of the more memorable weeks of my life. It was also very frustrating because I had no reason to. So from an analyst standpoint, I look and say the guy had no reason to think he was going to play well. This is the way you compete, or this is the way you train. You know, the contrary. You know, I had been playing well. I'd been hitting the ball well, and I expected to play well there. So I was quite frustrated with my inability to have any semblance of the form that I had going into the championship. But on the whole, it was just a beautiful week, you know, an absolute beautiful week for me. From the time I qualified, which was, you know, it was just great fun to get out there and to feel the juice, you know, just running through your veins and try to quell it and try to keep calm and focus and hit all the shots you needed. You know, it was, I did it for a lot of different reasons. You know, to have another, but also, and yes, I am going to try to play more. You know, and I have, I'm going to spend it practicing and just see, you know, how we think.
We shall see. It's going to be very interesting to watch. We certainly look forward to more opportunities to track you and watch you inside the ropes moving forward. But Brandel Chambly, as always, a great pleasure to have you on the podcast to talk a variety of topics. The season is winding down, but there's still plenty more to keep our attention.
Thanks so much, Will. Always love to talk to you. Yes, you're right. Look forward to the Ryder Cup, the FedEx Cup. The season's not done yet. We'll still have plenty to talk about in the next couple of months.
The golf world calendar keeps on spinning. Doesn't matter what part of the year we're in. But thanks again to Brandel. Again, I'm your host, Will Gray. This has been the Golf Channel Podcast presented by Top Golf. Remember, you can get access to our podcasts and those we've had previously with Brandel as well at golfchannel.com/podcast. Go to your favorite podcast provider, Apple, Stitcher, Art19, Google Play, search Golf Channel Podcast and subscribe. Feel free to leave a rating in a review. Tell your friends. Again, thank you very much, Brandel Chambly. I'm your host, Will Gray. This has been a Golf Channel Podcast presented by Top Golf. We'll see you next time.